coming up on Star Stuff. NASA's Mars Curiosity rover just days away from landing on the red planet, searching for an antimatter universe, and using star spots to work out how stars are rotating and whether their planets are going round the same way. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
NASA's most advanced planetary rover ever's right on the glide slope for its landing on the surface of the red planet Mars. The Mars Science Laboratory mission, which carries the giant Curiosity rover, should touch down on the frozen Martian surface at 1521 Australian Eastern Standard Time on August the 6th. It'll then take 13 minutes and 48 seconds for the data to reach Earth. Curiosity's landing will be one of the hardest missions ever attempted in the history of robotic planetary exploration. To achieve the precision needed for this landing, the Mars Science Laboratory spacecraft will need to fly like a wing through the upper atmosphere of the red planet instead of dropping like a rock. To land the one-ton car-sized rover, the airbag bouncing ball method used on previous Mars missions, including Pathfinder and both Mars Spirit and Opportunity, simply won't work. Instead, mission engineers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, have devised a new method called Skycrane for the final moments of the flight. A backpack with retro rockets controlling descent speed will lower the rover on three nylon tethers just before touchdown. During this crucial period of flight, described by NASA itself as 7 minutes of terror, the Mars Science Laboratory spacecraft carrying Curiosity needs to decelerate from something like 5,900 meters per second to allow the rover to land on the surface at less than a meter per second. Put simply, the 7 minutes of Martian entry and landing will be the most challenging part of the entire mission. For the landing to succeed, hundreds of independent yet critically related events will need to unfold correctly, many with split-second timing, and all controlled autonomously by the spacecraft's onboard systems. Just one thing needs to go wrong for the entire multi-billion dollar mission to be a disaster. Mars Science Laboratory Deputy Entry, Descent and Landing Operations Lead Devin Kitt from NASA JPL says the spacecraft's on a good trajectory and it's performing nominally with all systems looking good for its 21,000 kilometer per hour entry into the Martian atmosphere.
Curiosity is doing very well. We enter the atmosphere of Mars going about 13,000 miles per hour, and we have a period of 4 minutes that we call the entry phase, where we undergo intense heating and extreme atmospheric drag that slows us down from 13,000 miles per hour to about 1,000 miles per hour over the course of 4 minutes.
And it doesn't end there, of course. Because of the mass of the spacecraft, it's a big rover, a different system will be used to the type that's been used on past missions.
Yes. So many people are familiar with the airbag. You slow yourself to a relatively slow velocity using a parachute and rockets. And then in the past, we've inflated these large airbags and bounced around on the surface until we finally came to rest. Because Curiosity is so large, the airbags don't work for a system. They don't scale well with size. So we use a system we call the Skycrane. It's inspired by helicopters called the Skycrane helicopters that are used to position very heavy loads, for example, in construction projects.
Yeah, we use them for bushfires here in Australia.
I've seen pictures. It's inspired by that. We essentially had, in place of a helicopter, a descent stage, which has 8 rockets on it that hovers, and then lowered on a rope 20 meters below that is the Curiosity rover itself. The two vehicles lower slowly towards the surface, set the rover down directly on its wheel, and as soon as we detect that touchdown event, we cut the rope, and our descent stage, our helicopter proxy, flies away and lands at a safe distance.
Have you been able to test this very often on Earth with under the sort of conditions obviously haven't got the pressures, or the lack of pressure in the case of Mars, atmospheric pressure, but have you been able to test this? Has it worked? Are you comfortable with the way it's been working here on Earth?
Testing is the greatest challenge we face for a project like this. Because Mars is so very different from Earth, it's very difficult to think of ways of doing testing that's relevant to the environment we're going to face when we get to Mars. So you have to devise a test program that break all the chunks into little teeny pieces that are testable, and then it's an intellectual process to link all those pieces together and convince yourself your system will work as a whole. In terms of being able to do an end-to-end test of the sequence, it's not possible on Earth. So the first time we piece everything together and perform the entire sequence will be at Mars.
During its final approach and descent, Mars Science Laboratory will be closely monitored by a fleet of spacecraft in orbit around the Red Planet. These include the European Space Agency's Mars Express, as well as NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and Mars Odyssey. They'll be tracking and relaying information during these crucial 7 minutes of terror. ESA's Mars Express mission managers in Darmstadt, Germany, began optimizing their spacecraft's orbit several months ago in preparation for Curiosity's arrival. Mars Express will record the entry using its lander communications system, originally intended for the ill-fated Beagle 2 lander, which disappeared during its own entry into the Red Planet's atmosphere, never to be seen again. Following Curiosity's descent, Mars Express will relay its data to the European Space Agency's new Norcia deep space antenna near Perth. Meanwhile, NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter will also monitor the probe's arrival, but won't be aligned correctly to see the final minutes of the flight, including the crucial touchdown. That was the job of NASA's Mars Odyssey spacecraft. However, a maneuvering system glitch last month initially placed the orbiter into a bad position for Curiosity's descent and touchdown. However, the good news, according to Devin Kipp, is that those problems have now been resolved.
We did have a maneuver planned last week that was going to move the Odyssey spacecraft to an orbit where it could observe us during EDL and report real-time back to Earth how the spacecraft was doing. There was a minor snafu in that maneuver. But engineers on that project worked around the clock, figured out the problem, and they have performed another maneuver, and they are now in a correctly phased orbit. They're going to support Curiosity's landing real-time. We will get that real-time data.
And you've also got the help from the Europeans as well, I believe, with Mars Express.
Yes, we do. We have three orbiting spacecraft around Mars that we'll all be supporting. It's wonderful to have three.
That's Devin Kipp, the Deputy Entry, Descent and Landing Operations Lead for the Mars Science Laboratory mission, with mission control at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Back in June, NASA successfully narrowed the spacecraft's landing ellipse from an initial oval 26 kilometers long and 20 kilometers wide down to a nice tight 6 kilometer wide, 20 kilometer long ellipse. Mission managers say this should allow Curiosity to touch down in Gale Crater closer to its ultimate target, Mount Sharp, thereby allowing it to reach the mountain several months earlier. NASA's primary antenna for Curiosity's descent will be the Deep Space Network CSIRO tracking station near Canberra. The tracking station's Glenn Nagel says the CSIRO's Parkes Radio Telescope in the central west of New South Wales will also be closely monitoring Curiosity's journey through the Martian atmosphere.
For this particular landing, we want to have as much extra capacity as possible with all of our antennas. So all our three major antennas here at our tracking station will be focused on Mars and the orbiting spacecraft and the lander itself. And we're going to be using backup from the Parkes Radio Telescope for the first few minutes of the entry of the spacecraft into the atmosphere as it goes through peak heating and then starts to decelerate without atmospheric braking, and then parachute deployment. The Parkes Radio Telescope will be acting as just an ear, a spare ear for us to be able to pick up the tones from the spacecraft.
Now, you'll be there for touchdown as well?
Our station literally is the only one in field of view with Mars at that time. So as the spacecraft is approaching the planet in the last 12 hours or so, our Californian station will be watching, and then as the Earth turns, it'll set in their horizon and be in ours. So for the final sort of 3 hours before entry and then heading down through the atmosphere and towards landing, it will only be in the view of Australia and our Canberra tracking station.
That's Glenn Nagel from NASA's Deep Space Network CSIRO tracking station near Canberra. The targeted landing site for Curiosity is a 155-kilometre-wide impact basin known as Gale Crater, located just near the Martian equator. During the initial weeks after the actual landing, JPL mission controllers will put the rover through a series of checkouts and activities in order to characterise its performance on Mars, while gradually ramping up scientific investigation. Curiosity will then begin examining its surroundings,
to try and determine if the landing site and the local neighbourhood ever offered an environment which could have been favourable for the formation and existence of life. Scientists think the area may be one of the final resting places for Mars's lost surface water. And of course, water in a liquid state is a key ingredient for life as we know it. The landing site is near a 5-kilometre-high mountain known as Mount Sharp. The slope of this mountain is the mission's ultimate destination. Mission managers want to run Curiosity not just to the mountain but right up its lower slopes, allowing them to study the geologic and environmental history of the area. Curiosity is 2 times longer and 5 times heavier than its 2 preceding Mars rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, and it's equipped with 10 scientific instruments. It's carrying a nuclear generator to produce its own power, so it won't need to worry about dust from the Martian atmosphere falling on the solar panels, an ongoing problem not just with Pathfinder's Sojourner rover, but also with both the Mars Opportunity and Spirit rovers. Curiosity uses a mast with high-definition cameras and a laser to study targets at distances of up to 7 metres. The rover will also use a suite of scientific tools on a robotic arm to deliver rock samples and soil from the Martian ground to an onboard laboratory. Instruments can then reveal the chemical and mineral composition of the samples. One instrument, a type of laser, will use its beam to induce a spark on a target and then read the spark spectrum of light in order to identify chemical elements in the sample. Other instruments on the car-sized rover can examine the surrounding environment both from a distance to get an overall view or up close and personal by direct touch using the arm. The rover will check for the basic chemical ingredients of life and for evidence about the sort of energy in the area necessary for life to exist. The bottom line is, could a bug make a living on the surface of Mars? Curiosity will also assess factors which could be hazardous for life on Mars, such as the radiation environment. But don't expect lots of answers straight away. Mission managers at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory say just driving to the mountain from the landing site may itself take several months. A 7-ton particle detector taken aboard the International Space Station on the last flight of the Space Shuttle Endeavour is now beginning to unveil some of the secrets of the antimatter universe. Scientists say the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, or AMS, has already broken all records in registering some 17 billion cosmic rays and storing data on them for analysis back on Earth. The detector built by CERN, the European Centre for Nuclear Research, aims to establish whether there's an unseen dark universe woven into the cosmos. Scientists want to find out if there's a universe made of antimatter out there somewhere far away producing particles which the AMS may be detecting. Physicists say the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago, which brought the universe into existence, must have created equal amounts of matter and antimatter. Particles of antimatter have the same mass as ordinary matter, but opposite electrical charge. When matter and antimatter collide, they annihilate each other. So if equal amounts of matter and antimatter were created in the Big Bang, the universe shouldn't exist, and of course, that's clearly not the case. Exactly what happened and why is one of the great mysteries of the cosmos, which AMS is trying to investigate. Some hypotheses have even suggested that the invisible dark matter, estimated to make up about 25% of the known universe, could be linked to antimatter. However, most physicists say this is highly unlikely because dark matter is known to coexist with normal matter, like a sort of wafting veil between planets and stars in galaxy and galaxy clusters. And it's doing this without any annihilation taking place. The $2 billion AMS detector uses powerful magnets that bend particles with positive and negative charges in different directions. The data from AMS is being analysed by a team of 500 scientists around the world. However, researchers are cautious about how long it will take for any real discoveries to come out, especially compared with the recent confirmation of a totally new particle believed to be the long-sought-after Higgs boson at CERN's Large Hadron Collider. The boson is part of a force called the Higgs field that turned minute pieces of flying debris after the Big Bang into solid matter, bringing them together to form galaxies, stars, planets, and later on life. Scientists say they're not expecting any quick reports from the AMS of indications of dark matter, or for that matter, an antimatter mirror universe, at least not in the near future. NASA's Planet Hunting Kepler Space Telescope has, for the first time, confirmed that a distant planetary system is orbiting its host star in the same direction in which the star is spinning. The discovery supports existing theories that stars and planets are formed out of a single spinning gaseous disk. But that theory was based on only one previously known example, our solar system. So the new discovery provides important supporting evidence. Kepler finds planets by looking for a dip in light from a star as an orbiting planet passes in front of it as seen by the telescope. The amount of the dip in light provides clues as to the planet's size. The interval between dips gives the planet's distance from the host star, and the number of separate dip patterns detected tells astronomers how many planets are likely to be orbiting the star. The new study, reported in the journal Nature, used star spots, which are the same as sunspots, but on stars other than the Sun, to determine the rotation of the star. Scientists, including Dr. Daniel Fabricchi from the University of California, Santa Cruz, reached their findings by studying a planetary system 5,000 light-years away called Kepler-30. Kepler-30 includes a Neptune-sized world orbiting the star every 30 days, as well as two larger Jupiter-sized planets orbiting at 60 and 140 days, respectively. The host star is a younger version of our Sun. Astronomers could tell the star was younger because of its rapid rotation and the high amount of magnetic starspot activity on its surface. Detecting starspots allowed astronomers to determine the star's rate of rotation, as well as the direction of that rotation and the tilt of its spin axis. Fabricchi says the observations confirm that the planets in the system are all orbiting on a roughly common plane and in the same direction as the star's rotation and within 10 degrees of the star's equator.
Stars, as they age, become less magnetically active and they also slow down. Their rotation slows down because they're throwing off a wind into space and this causes them to slow down. This star is spinning at a 16-day spin rate, whereas our Sun is spinning at about a 28-day spin rate.
And you know that by looking at the star spot as it goes around?
That's right. So we have the photons from the star as a function of time, and they vary by a few percent over the 16-day cycle. And we interpret that as the star spots coming into and out of view.
And that's rather fortuitous because it's allowed you to look at the planets as well and work out exactly where they are orbiting in relation to the star itself.
That's right. So just as the planets cross in front of the star, these star spots are coming into view, and you can think of them as crossing in front of the star, and they're crossing on a certain chord across the disk of the star as we would see it. We don't actually resolve the disk of the star with this spacecraft. In fact, not many stars in the whole galaxy are resolved by any of our instruments. All we see is a point of light, and we see it flickering on this 16-day cycle, telling us about the star spots, and on these other very sharp dips due to the planets crossing in front. So what we've measured in this paper is the interaction of when the planets cross in front of the star. We are seeing them hit the star spots. We see them cross over the star spot. Instead of the telltale transit signature where you see the light from the star go down by 1%, well, we see the light go down by 1%, but then it goes up a little bit by about 10% of that 1%. It goes back up when the planets cross in front of this dark star spot. By timing the interactions between the planets and the star spot, we can tell that the planets are all crossing in front of the star, moving in the same direction. They're moving along with the star spot. That's the main data we are interpreting. And the main point of the paper is that the star is spinning in the same direction as all of the planets are orbiting.
And roughly along the star's ecliptic.
Yes, that's right. So the equator of the star, which is defined simply by its spin, is oriented within about 10 degrees of the orbits of the planet, and planets themselves are oriented within a few degrees of each other. So it's very much like solar system. The planes only differ by a few degrees. Pretty much all the planets are orbiting in the same direction and nearly the same plane around the Sun. And the Sun itself is also spinning in the same plane, with its equator only 7 degrees away from most of the planet.
The discovery of two Jupiter-sized planets in Kepler-30 also shows that at least some of these gas giants can form further out, just as Jupiter did in our Sun's solar system, and then move closer in through planetary migration caused by changes in orbital speed due to angular momentum. Daniel Fabricchi again.
Since the beginning of planets being discovered around sun-like stars, which happened only as recently as 1995, there's been this puzzle about how Jupiter mass and size planets can get into orbits only 3 days around their star, because our planet Jupiter has a 12-year period. The theories of how the solar system came to be are constructed to explain all the properties of the solar system, in particular the properties that the gas giant planets are at large distances, 12 years and beyond, that they're coplanar, lie in nearly the same plane with each other, and they orbit the same way as the star spins. And we have in exoplanetary science this really big puzzle that some of these Jupiter-like planets are in three-day orbits. And so until a few years ago, the standard hypothesis was that a planet forms in the disk and it slowly migrates, it spirals in towards the star, and it parks at a three-day orbit. If that's the case, we'd expect to see planets along the way that didn't quite make it down to the star, and that could be what this Kepler-30 system represents, a case where the planets formed further out and they moved by a large factor but didn't get quite down to the star. And that's quite consistent with the spin of the star being aligned with these planetary orbits, because the disk in which the planets were born and presumably migrated would also determine the spin orientation of the star as that material falls onto the star. So what I've said so far, it sounds like, okay, this is the missing link between the Jupiter and the hot Jupiters. The only issue is that we've measured the same kind of spin orbit alignment for hot Jupiters, and we find very often that they are misaligned. They do not obey this pattern that solar system and Kepler-30 obey. So our interpretation in this paper is that they come from some other dramatic events and not through the smooth spiraling in type interaction that I just described.
What sort of dramatic events would allow something as large as a planet to wind up orbiting as a hot Jupiter around a distant star in what could be any one of a gazillion, I know that's a scientific term, different orbits?
Okay, well, over the years there have been numerous theories coming out about this. The basic answer is, to move a planet so dramatically, you need something as big or bigger than it. The common theories that are propounded nowadays are a couple of planets interacting gravitationally can become chaotic and start having close passages and causing each other to go up to high eccentricity and also high inclination. In other words, they gravitationally scatter each other out of the original coplanar and circular orbit. And at this point, one of them can wander close to the star, at which point there's a tidal interaction, and it's sort of captured by the star, and the energy that's put into giant tidal waves is dissipated, and that draws the orbit in close to a three-day orbit. Now, that makes a strong prediction that there should be a second planet nearby with a scattered-looking orbit, in other words, high eccentricity. And so those planets might lurk at 5 AU or even further away from the star, and it motivates further observations to see if there are such guilty hand or the smoking gun or whatever you call it, these additional bodies that perturb the hot Jupiters. Another possible body would be a stellar companion. If there's a binary star, we know that about half of stars in the solar neighborhood have a companion star. And so if these stars formed with planets nearby and a companion star not very nearby, maybe 1,000 times the distance from the Earth to the Sun, that companion star can, over long periods of time, perturb the planet in towards its own star.
That's Dr. Daniel Fabricchi from the University of California, Santa Cruz. The first operational flight test of new spacecraft docking gear for Russian flights to the International Space Station has failed, casting doubts on the automated system meant to simplify missions to the orbiting outpost. The Russian Federal Space Agency Roscosmos was testing the new system on their Pirs module with the Progress cargo ship. The test was proceeding smoothly until the new Kurs-NA rendezvous system was engaged. As commands were being issued to activate the new system, a failure warning triggered, causing an abort. Kurs-NA is an upgraded version of the original Kurs docking system, which has been successfully used for years on both Russian manned Soyuz and unmanned Progress spacecraft. The new system consolidates five antennas into one, it uses updated electronics, and is designed to improve safety while using less power. Following the sudden abort, the Progress was moved to a safe parking orbit some distance from the space station, while Russian engineers tried to determine why the new rendezvous system failed. They eventually concluded the problem may have been as simple as the cold temperatures in which the system was operating. A second attempt was made after Japan's HTV-3 cargo ship carried out its own manual docking with the space station. And the second attempt by Progress went flawlessly. Mission managers say the equipment just needed time to warm up. The Progress had already delivered its fuel and supplies to the space station and was loaded with trash. So after the successful docking, the Progress was again undocked and deorbited from the space station, burning up in the atmosphere above the southeastern Pacific Ocean. Meanwhile, back on the ground, the next Russian Progress cargo ship bound for the International Space Station is due to launch this week from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in the Central Asian Republic of Kazakhstan. More on that next week. Speaking of launches, a Russian Proton rocket successfully blasted into space off Pad 24 at Baikonur.
8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have main engine startup, and we have liftoff of an ILS Proton rocket from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan with the SES-5 satellite on board. About 10 seconds after liftoff, the rocket did a roll maneuver and will soon experience maximum dynamic pressure, also known as max-Q, and this is the maximum aerodynamic load on the vehicle. For Proton, it corresponds to about Mach 1.6 and occurs 1 minute and 2 seconds after liftoff. Beautiful clear sky, and when conditions are right, a condensation cloud will form around the Proton as it passes through the sound barrier just prior to max-Q, leaving an annular cloud. When lighting permits, this is normal. It's not smoke, but rather it's moisture from the atmosphere that condenses into tiny water droplets due to the aerodynamic shockwave created by Proton. Can hear our comrades from the Russian bunker giving updates. Normalna. And we're coming up on the first stage separation. And I've received confirmation of stage 1-2 separation from Baikonur. And we have a signal of ignition of all four second-stage engines.
The three-stage Proton, together with its BREEZE-M upper stage, were carrying the SES-5 telecommunications and navigational satellite. The BREEZE-M then moved the satellite into an elliptical geostationary transfer orbit before separating 9 hours and 12 minutes after liftoff. Based on a Space Systems Lorel 1300 platform, the 6-ton SES-5 will use 38KU 24 C-band and a single L-band transponder for direct-to-home television services, as well as maritime communications and Galileo GPS signal verification services, all from geostationary orbit with a footprint covering Scandinavia, Europe, Asia and Northern Africa. The satellite's expected to have a 15-year lifespan. The mission was especially crucial, with mission controllers keeping a close eye on the spacecraft's deployment after a similar Space Systems Lorel telecommunications satellite, launched by Sea Launch back in May, failed to properly deploy its solar array, leaving it with a permanent partial power loss. Much to their relief, the SES-5 telecommunications satellite deployed its solar array flawlessly. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase. And that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science.